Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where hopefully the intelligence comes from my guests, in this case, Steve Wasserman, someone I knew a long time ago here in Berkeley, where we're doing our recording in the office of Heyday Books. But I knew him back then, oh God, four decades ago, when you were a high school student at Berkeley High, and you actually worked with legendary people like Tom Hayden and others who came through this town. And you've now recently published a book. You were most recently at Yale University Press, and you brought out a book of Tom's last writing about the Vietnam War. But you're here at Heyday Books, where you're now taking over a legendary Berkeley institution, so you can go home again. And between being in Berkeley High and now being at Heyday Books, you've been at Random House, you've been at Farrar Straus, you've been at Yale University Press, you've been a book editor for people like Susan Sontag and Christopher Hitchens. You've been in academic publishing, commercial publishing, and now you're back at Small Press Publishing. Heyday, for people who don't know it, is a great label here in California. You can discuss that a little bit. It's been around for how long?
42 years.
And but the point is, are you here because the book business is finished? Is it all over? Is it going to be just small little publishing houses? Not that that's a bad thing, but give me your take.
When the opportunity presented itself about a year ago to somersault back to Berkeley, where my parents still live and where I came of age in that fabled decade, the 1960s, it raised for me all the old existential questions. What did I want to do when I grew up, and where did I want to do it? I had spent nearly 40 years ping-ponging between the coasts, spending about half my professional life in Los Angeles, working two tours of duty at the Los Angeles Times, and then the other part of my professional life in New York City. But I felt when this opportunity arose that I still had a great deal of the scent of eucalyptus, night jasmine, and a wee bit of the Berkeley tear gas still in my nostrils. And I was done shoveling snow, and I had felt for the past nearly 11 years when I worked most of that time as a editor-at-large for Yale University Press that it felt like I was living in the suburban gulag of Connecticut because I could no longer cling to Manhattan, a place I once lived in. I had too many children, and forget about the kids. Maybe if I'm fortunate, they'll grow up, betray me, and leave. I had too many books, and the books were forever, and I still remain wed to the physical book and can't bear the thought of banishing them to some invisible library contained on a Kindle.
So if I were a hard-nosed editor at some publishing house, I'd say that's a very wonderful, poetic story. But what about the business aspect? Are books finished? Did you sail off to New York thinking that books could change the world, that they were highly relevant, that people lived for books, that movements were built around books, lives were built around books? We are now in an age where what? Do books come electronically, or if they come at all, you don't clutch them?
One of the reasons I first went to the Los Angeles Times was because I had begun to have a near contempt for the smaller magazines of culture and opinion and politics, whether of the right or the left, because I thought they appealed to ever smaller readerships that were whose prejudices were confirmed, and they were enrolled in mutual admiration societies. And the attraction of working at a place like the Los Angeles Times was the idea that you could be the midwife to ideas and voices and authors who might otherwise not be exposed to a large readership. And what I came to appreciate after a number of years at the LA Times, in the first incarnation working at the opinion section and the op-ed page, is I came to believe that no genuinely fresh or original idea was first written for a newspaper. That was not their mission. What they were good at, if they were any good at all, was the popularization of the news from elsewhere. So, for example, typically you might see in the Science Times section of the New York Times, you'll see a lead story that would say, as the New England Journal of Medicine will report in their upcoming issue. And what they were good at, again, if they were any good at all, is that they had reporters and columnists and writers who would translate the arcane specialized knowledge and languages of more specialized journals and popularize them for a lay, presumably sophisticated audience. So increasingly, I began to have a growing respect for the curious way in which ideas get generated and bubble up in the culture. Books have always had a disproportionate influence. Out of all the relationship between their influence and the actual number of readers can be very constrained. I remember the late Arthur Koestler, the famous author of Darkness at Noon, was once asked by an interlocutor that if he were given the choice between having 10 readers 100 years from now or 100 readers in the present, which would he choose? He replied unhesitatingly, of course, 10 readers 100 years from now. And then he paused and said, but I suppose my publisher, who hopes still to remain in business a century from now, would prefer that we have the 100 readers in the present. So, yes, I've always believed that ideas matter, that they influence the culture in curious and odd ways, and that the ways in which ideas are expressed fall through time and circumstance in ways that have to be respected. And the book, since the invention of the codex 500 or 600 years ago, has been a very significant transmitter of those ideas, and that even with the digital challenges and opportunities that have presented themselves, remain unrivaled, both for their tactile pleasures, the way in which people actually absorb deep knowledge through their fingertips, as it were, and that I continue to believe in them.
Let me jump in here, because you've been my agent, full disclosure, and actually my wife is going to come work and help you here with Heyday Books, and she was actually with you at the LA Times and so forth. So our paths have crossed, and I just want to tell you my own disillusionment with books. When I first met you, actually before I met you, I had some success in publishing books with Random House, where you worked or went to work, and elsewhere. And books had a certain vitality. There was an excitement about them. There were a lot of newspapers that reviewed books and so forth. Increasingly, and I've done, I don't know, 3 books in the last 10 years, and I think they're very good books. They're valuable. I worked hard on them. I feel like Willy Loman. I feel like I'm physically, literally schlepping these books around in the trunk of my car and show up at speaking engagements, and I don't have the pull of some major, you know, entertainment figure or something. So, but you get a good crowd. You get a couple of hundred people that come, and maybe you sell 30 books or 50 books even. It's a good night, but it turns out to be the main way you sell books. And there's that sense that maybe your audience is dying, or maybe books don't matter, or maybe people are just buying the books to make you feel good. And I was thinking in your case, you were the publisher, the agent, I forget the exact label, for Susan Sontag.
No, I was never Susan Sontag's agent, nor did I ever publish a book by Susan. She was my friend and encourager, something of an anti-MAME figure for me. She was kind enough to give me a blurb on occasion for other writers that I published, but I was never her publisher.
Okay, well, you were close to her.
Yes, I think that could
be said.
And
her son, who's also a very good writer, David Reif, worked at...
he worked at Farrar, Straus & Giroux as an editor for about a decade.
And so anyway, let's just... So she, who didn't represent her, but let's talk about Susan Sontag, who you certainly knew very well. And she would deal with complex ideas, and she had come from the academic world and was quite sophisticated in her thinking, but she could find a very large audience and provoke a very significant public debate about different issues. I remember once running what we called, the title was 18,000 words about Sweden. social democracy in Sweden, or what it meant. And people thought we were crazy. That was in Ramparts magazine. But we got a big readership for it, and I think it was even turned into a book of some sort.
Never turned into a book, and it remains one of the few pieces she ever wrote that has never been collected in any subsequent book of hers. But a piece I admired at the time and admired to this day, 47 years after it first appeared, for its memorable opening sentence, which was, "The experience of any new country is always a battle of clichés," which I always thought was a rather profound and insightful way of thinking about such an experience.
But could one imagine Susan Sontag publishing to any effect today?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I can. First of all, Susan Sontag was never, until her book in the mid-70s, which was drawn from her four-part essay published originally in the New York Review of Books in the middle-70s, her Reflections on Photography, that was really the first book she had that became a bestseller. And it wouldn't be until her novel, much later in the early 90s, became a bestseller. She was never a best-selling author. But her influence was, again, out of all proportion to the actual number of books that she published. She catapulted to notoriety and considerable fame in 1964. She was all of 31 years old. Of age, and she had written a remarkable piece for a very small publication called Partisan Review, and it was called Notes on Camp. And timing being everything, she had a take on some of the avant-garde movements of the early 60s and expressed herself in so articulate and vivid a fashion that she became the intellectual du jour. And so, and because she was also beautiful, or at least so many people thought so, she combined both braininess and beauty, which was an irresistible combination for the editors of Vogue magazine and Time magazine. They put her on the cover. Many more people read about Susan Sontag than ever bothered to actually read her.
So I want to bring up another writer of yours that you did represent and was close to, Christopher Hitchens, and his own evolution, and also connected with the, because he wrote about Orwell towards the end, and the whole image of Orwell in the life of the left and the life of political literature, and there, you know, there are different messages there. One is, yes, rebel. Yes, don't accept. Yes, change conditions. On the other hand, be careful of what you create. It can go awry. And Hitchens ended up sort of being consumed by this question at the end.
I think there's little doubt but that Christopher Hitchens, at least by one measure, earlier in his political life, was very fond of an aphorism of Oscar Wilde's, which goes to this point. Oscar Wilde, if I recall rightly, once said or wrote that he trusted no man whose dictionary did not include the word utopia. And later on in his life, Christopher came to believe, as he would write, that increasingly he trusted no man whose dictionary did include the word utopia, for precisely the reasons you suggest, that there was something in both Castro's pursuit of the remaking and Che Guevara's pursuit of the remaking, not in a religious sense, in a secular sense, to out of the crucible of history form this a new alloy, a new man with, you know, more purified, more noble, more enlightened. That way led to a lot of monstrous things. There is a kind of fascist deformation of this, and there's a kind of, as it were, Bolshevik deformation. But both are united in a kind of almost theological impulse to take, as Kant put it in a wholly other context, to take the broken timber of humanity and to straighten it out. The trouble with that is that it's baked into our DNA. And there is something about it kind of irons out or sandpapers away the very things that make us human and complex and full of nuance, and attempts to enroll us in a more rigorous order, or tries to banish complexity. And I think that way,
but
you know,
you've limited
doesn't,
the examples you've cited are the ones that are familiar and they're comforting to people of more traditional political centrist views. Okay, it's those oddball fascists and communists and their and so forth, but it also immediately extends, as Christopher Hitchens pointed out, to religion, which of course is a movement of demanding change in the human personality and so forth. But it also extends to a pragmatic, free market missionary movement that has dominated the U.S. role and in much of the world, that you know what the good life is, you know what modernization is, you have a right to impose it. You know what being civilized is all about. You know what being free is all about. You know, one of the things that I wrote, my Vietnam pamphlet, I ended by saying, you know, Camus had condemned the Soviets for imposing, in the case of Hungary, a socialism of the gallows. And then I wrote, you know, but isn't Vietnam a democracy of the gallows? And we've had democracy or freedom of the gallows, and insisting on freedom. And you see it in the current world. You see it in the argument about Libya or Syria, or intervening in other people's history so dramatically. And you get what was the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if not such a judgment? Or what we do with our high-tech weapons and continue to do.
Well, there's a lot packed into that observation. I mean, one of the ironies, of course, with respect to Vietnam is that we now have ostensibly a single-party state run by the Communist Party of Vietnam, which has embraced a kind of gallows of consumerist choice. I mean, they're running as fast as they can to provide for their people as much, economic opportunity and consumer goods of all kinds, and it led at least one fervent and long-standing opponent of America's involvement in Vietnam, the late Tom Hayden, to make an observation in this book that's now being published by Yale University Press called Hell No, The Forgotten Power of the Vietnam Peace Movement. He made the rather mordant and melancholy observation, based on a trip he and his wife and then young son took to Vietnam to revisit and to visit with revolutionaries he had met in the throes, in the midst of the war, a trip he took in 2007. And as he went around what is now called Ho Chi Minh City, the former Saigon and Hanoi, and the spectacle of seeing Hondas and other consumer goods, he asked himself the question, so what did it all mean? What was this whole war about? When in the end, the ideology seemed to pale next to the seductions of all the consumerist glories that at least a more rigorous and more Spartan ascetic Ho Chi Minh seemed to have stood against. Was it all for nothing? Maybe the values inculcated in that more either morally or aesthetically rigorous order promised by a certain kind of communism, really, at the end of the day, didn't really appeal to people, and if people were going to vote with their, if it was put to a vote, what they wanted was a kind of consumerist wonderland, but without another power telling them that that was what they had to do.
Time for a break from Sheer Intelligence. We'll be back in a minute. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and continue our discussion. You know, what I think has happened is not that these other people had the answer. They don't even have the answer for themselves, but they have the right to have the answer for themselves. That's the good part of nationalism. And that is something that we And by we, I mean not just our governments on the West. I mean the bulk of our intellectuals, our experts, our journalists, basically denied. And I see the big argument of the last 60 years as, unfortunately, I would have liked to think it was an unnecessary argument because it was obviously wrong in the way we assert it. But there was an assumption that the West, particularly coming out of World War II, had the answers for the planet and could impose them. And we could make a quick break with the old-fashioned colonialism, imperialism, and we would have something now that was virtuous in every respect, and so virtuous that we had the right to impose it on people. And that's how I look at Cuba and Vietnam, for example, two places where the young left that you were part of got so involved with. I think the real issue was hegemony versus independence for these people, for better or worse.
I don't disagree with any of that, but nor does it relieve us of the obligation of assessing and making judgments about the nature and evolution of these movements that resisted American hegemony. We should not deny the agency that the Chinese pursued. I mean, we cannot simply whitewash the crimes of the Cultural Revolution.
No.
We saw the deaths of millions.
No, we shouldn't
just say, you know, they had this idea. We there was something called Maoism. It was quite strict. It was quite punitive. And so we have an obligation, if we're to be thinking, fully alive human beings, to try to parse the very complicated interplay of these various factors.
I think that's very
important. And we should not leave this analysis and this judgment to those on the right who would have a certain view of this, but use it as a cudgel with which to beat the rest of us into submission. We need to claim the right to be critics and the right of serious thinking. I think it's incumbent upon us to do so.
Yes, and I'm not disputing that at all. What I am suggesting is the centrality questioning of the we. We're sitting here in a dark room now because I thought the fluorescent lights would be making noise, and we're at the Heyday Books, which is a book publishing company in Berkeley that is, how old did you say it?
42 years old,
and Steve Wasserman, you have gone from being the book editor of the Los Angeles Times, and a very high-powered book agent and editor and New York editor and so forth, and you're now here at a publishing house that actually distinguished itself by recognizing the wisdom of Native Americans, right?
Yeah, Malcolm Margolin, its founder, founded the place with a book that he wrote as a young man, which remains in print nearly half a century later, called The Ohlone Way, because as a recently minted Harvard graduate, a Jewish kid who grew up on the wrong side of the tracks in Boston, who makes his way out to Berkeley in the flush of the ebullience of the 60s and California still beckoning, comes out here with a VW bus and his wife and settles in Berkeley, gets a job as a park ranger in Tilden Park, and he starts to wonder, well, who lived here before white people came here? And he takes himself to the Bancroft Library, and like any, you know, studious yeshiva booker, he starts to read about, to the extent that it was written about, the 10,000-year-old history of the indigenous peoples of the place who had survived, and there were some 116 tribes, many of them speaking languages as complicated and as unintelligible one to the other as Hungarian is to Chinese or Japanese is to English. And he became fascinated by this and so founded Heyday. And one of its missions over the course of subsequent four decades was to champion the cause of indigenous peoples. It's been exemplary in doing so.
There's a wisdom to this founder of Heyday that we're paying homage to by sitting here trying to get to some essential truths. And I think it's a unifying point. I think, first of all, to take your previous point, as human beings, we always have to be responsible for our actions and our thoughts and what we've condoned, what we've failed to challenge, what we've supported, when we didn't speak up, when we did speak up. And that applies whether you're on the left or right. It applies whether you're part of the most powerful nation in the world, which we have been, the United States, or you're in some small backward country that doesn't have much impact over a lot of people. You still have a responsibility. I think there's the key point that I was trying to make before, and I suspect you don't disagree, is the dangerous thing is the notion that some group of people have the right to make these decisions for other people.
I completely agree. And you made that point very eloquently, memorably, in the aftermath of the Jim Jones Kool-Aid debacle.
Yeah.
And where you said, you ended your piece by saying, well, maybe it's time we sort of, you know, leave off the Karl Marx for a little bit and revisit the works of John Stuart Mill.
Yeah. And so I want to, and maybe it's time we leave the big publisher or the big mass media and come to a small publisher. Mm. So here we are, two people now. I'm certainly at the end of my journey or very close to it. Hopefully you have a few more decades to go. I'm 80, you're 64. But I think, remember the whole thing of Jerry Brown, our governor, who's turned out to be quite enlightened leader of California, the great who thought we'd be not only the sixth biggest economy in the world, but as my wife Narda Zucchino pointed out in her recent book, we're also a trendsetter for the world in a good way. But he used to stress very much that notion of small is beautiful that he got from his guru at the moment, forget his name now. But the idea that somehow the world, first of all, is not our playground. It's not our piece of clay to mold. And unfortunately, being born and functioning and having some influence in the most powerful country in the world, which American intellectuals have, you get into this notion that somehow we do know best or have a feeling for what's right and wrong and have to make big decisions about whether people get bombed or not, you know, or do we speak out against it or do we support it? This is what the debates that people have. I had one with Christopher Hitchens, or I think I had about five of them with Christopher Hitchens over the Iraq War. And the reason I brought up the experience of Heyday and being small and the indigenous problem, maybe this is a plea for being and not thinking we are so important to the drama, going back to knitting, if you like, to going back to painstaking inquiry and building. And maybe what we really should be aspiring for now is a much more of a multipolar world, and being much more respectful of different ways of approaching it. And after all, the whole consciousness about indigenous movements is a recognition that people we had dismissed as primitive might have had wisdom.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think one of the things that Heyday has stood for throughout its long years of publication is something that Malcolm articulated very wonderfully, which is that Heyday stood for trying to preserve and discover and promulgate notions and books that celebrated beauty and joy. There was too little of it in our lives. And throughout all of that was threaded an idea of stewardship that pushed against the notion of our species as parasites, with a overweening imperial ambition to conquer, to colonize, to bulldoze other peoples, and not only other peoples, but the very planet itself. And there was this idea that you mentioned about small is beautiful, or respect for the local, respect for traditions that have been bulldozed into extinction, that was a part of the discoveries of movements that came out of the 60s. And they had very different kinds of expressions, but they exist in a complementary form. I mean, what was Alice Waters' Chez Panisse restaurant all about? But it as an outgrowth of trying to suggest that the way we eat, it has something to do with the way we live. And she pushed back against this idea of a militarized food industrial complex, which in its pursuit of profits had severed the connection, a necessary connection, between people and the land, between the farmers and the cities, rural and urban. And while it's possible to fall into the temptation of romanticizing these things, there was a great truth there up to a point. And Heyday, as a publisher, was a vessel for both the, as I say, the discovery of old ideas of beauty, which could nonetheless be defended and preserved and extended into a present and future whose culture all around us was largely trying to demolish those things. And so it was a kind of defensive action, rear guard action. So to put it another way, just as there are virtues to what's been called the slow food movement, perhaps there's some virtue to what I might call the slow reading movement. And it goes back to your original question about books. I mean, we live in a culture that prizes swiftness and the acceleration of everything. The internet, for all its virtues, is probably the first communication system created since the dawn of mankind and since Hammurabi's tablets, that rewards one's first thought as one's best thought. And in a very crowded world in which it's difficult to carve out the time to think and to reflect, to arrive at something that might actually be passed for what might be considered wisdom, it's important that there exist little islands, and perhaps Heyday is one of those little islands where space can be carved out and defended so that people can be attracted to it and who can think about the values that make us fully human.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
This is Robert Scheer. I've been doing this edition of Scheer Intelligence with Steve Wasserman, and our producers are Joshua Scheer and Rebecca Mooney, our technical staff at KCRW, Kate Yore and Mario Diaz, and we're broadcasting, amazingly enough, from our little old hometown here of Berkeley.